This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Agustin Fuentes. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. He will be speaking tonight in a lecture titled Human Evolution, A Cocktail of Creativity. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. It's at 6:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you write about a number of things, including this whole idea of human nature, which is a term that everybody uses, usually without having really thought through what that means. You study both human beings and primates. What of our own nature can we understand, do you think, from studying primates?
Well, one of the things that people forget all the time is that humans are animals, right? We're a particularly interesting animal, but we're animals nonetheless. And studying the other primates, our cousins, if you will, gives us an idea of the sort of baseline. You know, where do we start when we ask big questions about humans? Well, many people associate certain things with humanity. Very tight-knit, complex social lives, very dependent children, long, complex social realities. All of those things are characteristic of humans, but they're also characteristic of primates, blue whales, orcas, elephants, a variety of other things. That's not what makes us human. That's what we share with other kinds of close related beings.
Although it does take us a lot longer to grow into adulthood, doesn't it?
You know, if you look at some of the great apes, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, or if you look at many of the cetaceans, whales, they're pretty close. It takes us a little bit longer, especially in the modern day.
Right.
But that's something else.
35.
Altogether. Right. Yes, most gorillas leave home before their late 20s.
Right. And so when we look at that, what you call baseline, and we see those things in common. I mean, you're talking about close-knit social groups. What else? I mean, what else do we have in common with those creatures?
We care a lot for one another, particularly those who are very close to us. We invest a lot in our offspring, and we invest a lot in our social relationships. Those who we live with, those in our group, the day-to-day interactions matter. More than just finding food or finding mates or fighting. It really matters who we hang out with and how we hang out. Being a good primate is really hanging out well.
So there are a lot of things that people make assumptions about, and one of the things that is a kind of assumption about human evolution and indeed the evolution of all species is a great focus on competition. And that focus on competition is something that has worked its way into almost a kind of mythological or ideological worldview that seeps into capitalism, which is based on competition and things like that. What is the role of competition from your perspective, and what else are you looking at to temper that kind of ideology?
So there's so many things going on here. Let me break down a couple really important ones. The first is that competition is very important for all organisms. But so is cooperation. And there's mounting evidence from the fossil record, from molecular biology, from genetics, from behavioral biology, ecology, and conservation research, that cooperation actually might be more important in the history of life than competition. Now, we can table that for a moment. But let me point out, most people like to invoke survival of the fittest as a term to reflect what evolution is. Remember, Darwin did not come up with that statement. In fact, in the first edition of Origin of Species, he does not use that phrase anywhere. Herbert Spencer convinced him to use that in the second edition and on. And it doesn't actually refer to direct competition.
What does it refer to?
Well, survival of the fittest really means that those organisms that do best in a given environment and pass on average, the most number of offspring will be more represented, or their traits will be better represented in future generations. That's sort of boring. That's not the way people want to think about it. They want to think about two male elk there battling till one of them dies and then the other one gets all the females. That's not actually the way the world works.
And you know what's funny is I once saw I think it was like some kind of National Geographic thing where two elks were battling to the death over some female, and a third male elk was kind of looking on, and the two who were fighting got tired, and the third guy went off with the girl.
Right. So the world is really complicated. And so when we think about competition, we can understand that it's very important, but it never exists by itself. It exists in the context of a larger cooperative pattern and process. Competition doesn't make sense for most organisms outside of the cooperative social group. So it's really complicated, but we can really say that competition isn't the only thing or even the main thing driving evolution.
One of the things that I think people are surprised to hear is that most of the history of life on Earth was single-celled organisms. And when you think about single-celled organisms swimming around for eons in the primordial soup, it kind of takes some real cooperation for them to get together with each other and say, hey, why don't the three of us make another organism? And hey, why don't the 10 of us cells make something else? And that's the beginning of it.
So there's a great book by Ken Weiss and Ann Buchanan called The Mermaid's Tale that actually walks us through the role of cooperation in the evolution of life on this planet. It's really, really important. Again, not to say that competition isn't important and doesn't happen, but that if we step back and ask how does stuff get more complicated over the 4 billion years of, history of this planet, cooperation is right at the center. And that doesn't go away when we talk about more complicated animals, humans, primates, wolves, blue whales. These kinds of organisms rely heavily on getting along to be able to do things. But I do have to say, the research of mine and those of many other people demonstrate that humans are particularly adept at cooperating and collaborating. We do it in a way that is almost years beyond almost everything else.
One thing that I've noticed is sometimes people who have a great ideology of competition being the essence of human nature, if you ask them, when was the last time that you had an aggressive or violent encounter with somebody? It's been a while. That's not the norm.
If they're lucky. Yeah. And no, you're right. It's not the norm. But really, people misrepresent aggression and violence as competition all the time. Let's think about this. I mean, where do we think of as the height of the most sort of successful competition for humans? Warfare, right? Aggression and violence. If you ask yourself, how do you win at war? The side that cooperates best is actually much better at warfare. So the idea of competition and cooperation as two separate things is completely wrong. The two are wrapped up in humans. And people will think about fights as very important because they stand out. Because that kind of overt violence and aggression is actually sort of weird for humans. We ignore all of the rest of the stuff. Let me give you an example. No one would be surprised if the headline read tomorrow, 4 people killed in New York City. And we're like, of course, yeah. But the headline that we'll never see that is much more important in an evolutionary sense is 7,999,996 people got along today in New York City. And right. That's what we do day in and out. If you ever walk down Fifth Avenue in New York, you're shocked that no one's killing each other. But they're not. They're getting along. Every day we stand in lines. We help people carry things. We organize together and work together. And people just take that for granted without recognizing it. That's actually the baseline of what humans do.
And I think one of the ways that they do it is by making rules. I was struck by, when I was a very small child, my dad, who was a professor, had a sabbatical and went to Italy. And in Italy, they don't always stand in line. They stand in front of the counter and everybody vies for the attention of the grocer. And, there are little old ladies who were sort of hitting my dad and trying to get in front of him. And once you say, okay, the rule is you stand in line, that kind of aggression and competition goes away.
Yeah. So we do. We make rules all the time. But what's really amazing, and different societies do it in different ways, right? There are many successful ways to be human. We've shown that. Humans are incredibly diverse in how they get stuff done. But they share these commonalities. I mean, if you put small children anywhere on the planet together, small children fight a lot, right? Small children can be quite aggressive. But when negotiating, when trying to deal with conflicts, children almost always begin with sort of a kind of bartering, an exchange, a kind of cooperative solution building or solution, cooperative solution to a conflict. And that happens all around the world. And so the ultimate system, standing in line or everyone yelling for the person's attention, that varies cross-culturally. But the collaboration to get to something done is actually a human pattern.
Now, to what extent do we see, and what are the specific ways that we see cooperation in other species?
So, differentiating cooperation between humans and other species is problematic sometimes, because we do see cooperation in many things. So ants cooperate unbelievably, right? They give their lives to the hive, if you will. But they have a particular genetic system. They have a very constrained kind of cooperation. It's very effective, as do many other organisms. As we get more complex social mammals, like wolves, let's say, we see a lot of cooperation in raising of pups, right? So let's say one of the females has pups. Many of the other females and males will help raise those pups. And that's kind of an investment in the social group. But in humans, we take it to a whole nother level. We are capable of a kind of reflective thought that allows us to question many of these investments. And yet we do it more consistently and more intensively than almost anything else.
We're talking to anthropologist Agustin Fuentes. What are some of the ways that human beings cooperate that stand out to you?
Well, teaching is a really fascinating thing. Many things have what we call social facilitation. Many things learn about the world by being with others of their own group or their own species. But humans have active teaching. We invest cooperatively in a kind of mentorship of providing information. And so that is one amazing example. There's a whole bunch of other kind of cooperation that we see in the recent human history. And by recent, since I'm very interested in deep time, by recent I'm talking the last 10,000 years or so, we see incredible things like domestication, agriculture, towns, cities, sewers, governments, schools, all of those things. When we step back and ask, look at how much we have to work together intensively to make these things function. It's really impressive. And it's not based on genetic relatedness. It's not based on some sort of physiological predetermined process. We have a lot of options. And yet of all those options, we almost always choose to collaborate to get something done.
So how did we get that way? And it's not that other animals don't do it. I mean, you see wonderful, I'm sort of addicted to YouTubes of animals doing amazing things, especially in nature. And you see otters teaching their little baby otters to swim. And you see all kinds of ways in which animals help each other and sometimes help animals of different species, which seems to be kind of a meme going around. But how did human beings get to such a sophisticated level?
Well, we come from primates, right? We are primates. So there's a cooperation, particularly social collaboration, is very common in primates. So again, our baseline was already complicated group living, helping each other out, sort of learning things via social mediation. But humans then, our lineage, and I'll talk more about this in the presentation tonight, our lineage did some particular things. They've came up with particular solutions to the challenge of the world. For example, if you drop back 2 million years ago, when the first members of our genus, the genus Homo, our deepest ancestors that are sort of, we know are on our line. And you look at them, they were about maybe 5 foot tall, 4.5 foot tall. They were naked. They had no horns, no fangs, no claws. They had some sticks and a few stones. And at the same time, there were 17 different kinds of predators out there in the East African woodlands that weighed 60 kilos, right? 130 pounds or more, all of which ate our ancestors. So again, short, naked, no claws, no fangs, no sort of horns. What did they have? They had each other. They worked collaboratively and socially to develop new ways of avoiding predation. And that is one of the most incredible examples. There's a wonderful book called Man the Hunted by some of my colleagues. And it walks us through the fossil and archaeological evidence showing how predation helped us become better humans.
So we are safer from predators and we are better predators.
Both because of cooperation.
Because of cooperation.
Yeah. Hunting is hard.
Yeah.
And hunting with others, we don't see this till more recently. And again, I'm talking about deep time here, but we don't see what we think of as sort of modern coordinated group hunting until about 300,000 years ago. But even earlier than that, we did other things that started to shift the balance for early humans or our ancestors versus other things out there competing for the same kinds of ways of life.
How does our hunting, our cooperative hunting, compare to that of our nearest primate relatives?
It's very different. And actually, primates don't make the best comparison for human hunting because most primates don't hunt, right? Chimpanzees do hunt sometimes. Some other species do hunt in a solitary fashion. But most primates don't do any cooperative hunting, just chimps a little bit. The better example might be wolves, orcas, dolphins, different very complex social mammals that get together, that coordinate with the aim of obtaining a prey. So our models are better for that. But humans do it even more complex, in more complex ways. Part of that is now we have language. And language helps us a lot because we can do things a lot of other organisms can't. But even when we didn't have language, before any evidence that we have what we would think of as modern language, we still had some pretty complicated ways of collaborating to get stuff done. And it's not all about hunting animals. There's a lot of other ways in which we extracted food from the world around us.
What are some of those other ways pre-agriculture that we cooperated to extract food?
Well, one of the most interesting new bits of data we have is about something called power scavenging. So there's a real conundrum in understanding human evolution because right about 2 to 1 million years ago, our brains really grew in size. And that really opened up a door for a lot of new types of cognition and behavior that set the stage for our evolutionary processes. But how do you grow a big brain? Brains are ridiculously expensive. Right now, all of you listening to us, your brain is eating up about 20 to 25% of all the energy in your body. That's a lot. And so to grow a brain, to double the size of your brain, you need a lot of protein. One way to get that is meat. That's probably one of the most readily available ways to get it. But getting meat is very difficult. It is not easy to get meat. And this is before we have any evidence of real hunting. So we've long thought that humans or human ancestors started scavenging. So we have good evidence for scavenging. So we see that evidence because you can look at these 2-million-year-old kills and you can find predator marks. And on top of those predator marks on the bones, you find evidence that stone, sharp flakes were used to cut the meat from the bone. What was left? So our ancestors would hang out, wait till two or three different kinds of things got the food, the carcass, and then run and scrape off a little bit of meat.
So we're just basically gnawing on the bones that
were left.
Lion or the wolf.
Right. Now, that's not very exciting, and people don't like us as the sort of vultures of the animal kingdom, but we're not. What we started doing, and there's pretty good evidence, is that slowly, because we were getting better at avoiding predation, we started to note what the predators were doing, or at least our ancestors did. And maybe every now and then, we'd follow those predators, or our ancestors would, and notice they'd make a kill. And if you could somehow get that kill away from the predator before the good meat got taken off and get there and cut that meat off, then you'd do really well. And so slowly but surely, over long periods of time, our ancestors pushed that a little bit and figured out ways to get the kills from predators. Let the predators make the kills and then have us or our ancestors take away some of the meat first. And how do we see that? Well, we actually see evidence of a transition from those cut marks that our ancestors made with stone tools on top of the predator gnaw marks to the reverse. The cut marks are first and the gnaw marks are second. And that shows us this big transition in becoming human.
Do you think that we learned to hunt from other animals like wolves that hunted in packs?
Yes, I think wolves, hyenas, a variety of other forms, actually that was one of our skill sets that many other organisms don't have, is our way of seeing ourselves in the world, but also part of the world and able to maybe manipulate the world a little bit. Many organisms impact the world. It's called niche construction, sort of. As the world challenges them, they respond to those challenges by changing a little bit of the world. Beavers do that when they build dams, right? Earthworms do that when they modify soils. Birds do that by building nests. Humans, however, are master niche constructors.
To the point of our own destruction at
this
point.
We've sort of taken this to the nth degree. And right now, you know, climate change has deep history, deep roots in human existence. It's not just the last 200 years or 300 years since the Industrial Revolution. It's a culmination of a long-term process of responding, of working together as groups to change the environment so that it's better for us. The problem is our technology has become so incredibly efficient that we've overshot the boundaries, and the context for change is coming back to bite us in the butt.
It's interesting that you say that the roots of climate change, and I think all the other kinds of ecological destruction that we're doing, you know, pollution and building on wetlands and destroying ecosystems and overusing the soil to the point where it's terribly depleted. I mean, all of these things are part of what you're calling niche construction, which so many creatures do in one way or another. Tell us more about that as a feature of evolution, all evolution, not just human.
So what's really interesting now is we've gotten to a point in evolutionary biology where we have what we call the extended evolutionary synthesis. We've gone way beyond just Darwinian notions and really expanded out to include ecological, genetic, epigenetic. We know more about how things change on the planet. Niche construction is one of the main processes in evolution, just like natural selection. So many organisms do it. So the way we can envision this is that organisms are challenged, groups of organisms are challenged by the environment. And when they respond to those challenges, sometimes they change the very factors in the environment that are challenging them. So when beavers show up in a new pond, pair of beavers show up, they start building a dam. What happens is they build the dam and they change the water flow, they change the temperature patterns in the water, they change the fish structure, some of the soil chemistry, and some of the crustaceans that live in that area. They're ecosystem engineers. And what happens? When they have their offspring are born into an environment that is better suited for beavers than the environment was before the original beavers got there. So ecosystem engineering leads to what we call ecological inheritance. You inherit the changes that the generations before you did.
Now, in the case of beavers, do they also make life better for some of the other species in these beaver ponds?
They make life better for some and much worse for others.
Talk about that.
And so this is the sort of cascade, right? So as you create these eddies, you create changing flows. So those species that lived in this stream pre-beaver who relied on the fast movement of water, they're going to get shifted out. Their niche, their range is going to be reduced. Whereas other species, some species that relied on small eddies, let's take brown trout or particular kinds of crustaceans like crawfish, they might actually benefit by new pools, new little ecological landscapes that the beavers created. So what's fascinating about niche construction is that the organisms that do this best don't do it just for themselves. They do it for everything else living in that same ecology. So now let's step back and ask the question about humans. So we have been doing niche construction for a long time.
Tell us about our very early niche construction.
Okay, so right away, we can see hundreds of thousands of years ago, humans started focusing on particular types of stone tools, which they were then able to use to focus on particular types of foods. Early hunting, early use of storage organs like roots and things like that, which changes just slightly the roles of predators and prey around them, and also the landscape. As we get a little bit closer in time, in the last 20 or 30,000 years, well before agriculture, we know that human populations are getting a little bit larger. And for example, in Southeast Asia, there's been some very good work on the island of Borneo showing that over about 20,000 years, there's been radical shifts in the makeup of plants and trees in rainforests pre-agriculture because humans were preferentially selecting certain types of trees and plants and sort of helping them versus others. So we get changes in forest ecologies and ecosystems that are not based on local climate shift, but rather human shift. So the ecologist Earl Ellis has a great term for this. He talks about humans going from having little human populations creating what he calls human weather, right? Local changes to human climate, global changes. And we're now in the mode of the Anthropocene, where the global climate is in fact human-modified, altered, and induced.
And we have thereby been able to increase our population to a point where we basically have no natural predators who can really make any impact on our population.
Yeah, well, not completely. First of all, the biggest predator of humans are other humans, first.
Yeah.
But we've also created a landscape of modification called anthromes, right, sort of the Anthropocene, human-modified ecologies, which has opened up a whole bunch of new venues for a particular kind of problem for humans, viruses. We've created new landscapes. We're seeing viral leaps and viral mutations at a rate and pattern that we've probably never seen in human history. And all of that is because of the way we've altered the world, niche constructed. So our niche construction actually has really benefited viruses.
And so viruses are now our main predators as opposed to lions and tigers and
bears. Oh my.
Oh my. Right. And yet, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like we are still kind of wired to be frightened of big, scary, monster-like creatures, much more than we are to be scared of things like viruses, which we evolved to not even know about.
Right, right. So I think this is very interesting because it really depends on sort of the cultural ecology. So some people are afraid of big, scary things, particularly urban dwellers today.
Everybody's scared.
Well, but it's really interesting because in a lot of people who live in rainforests, for example, they know which big things to be scared of and which ones not to be scared of. So context is everything. But we are primates, right? And primates have a long history of being eaten by larger things with fangs and claws. And so our deep history, of course, makes us very aware of large things running at us with claws. We want to avoid that.
And snakes.
And snakes. So Lynn Isbell, a primatologist, wrote a really good book about this sort of deep fear of snakes. However, I've got to point out that snakes are dangerous to a lot of primates, but only certain kinds. So I've seen many cases where I'm hanging out with a group of monkeys, and all of a sudden they all stand up, which is awesome to look at, and they mob a snake. They'll attack these different snakes.
The poisonous ones?
Yeah, frequently poisonous ones are pythons. But some snakes they ignore. And so they can tell frequently which is the dangerous one and which is the non-dangerous one. And most human populations throughout most of history have been able to do that too. Now, humans are really disjoint from the sort of their local ecologies, even in urban environments. So most humans now just say all snakes are dangerous or all large animals are dangerous. We have this sort of ignorance of what's dangerous and what's not because we've cut off a lot of the experiences that used to characterize a lot of human existence.
How do the monkeys that you're talking about know which snakes are dangerous and not? I mean, we living here in the Southwest know because we learn and we read.
So they learn by being a monkey. And this is back to the beginning of our conversation about social connections. So when young monkeys grow up in a monkey group, they're hanging around all the time with their peers, the same age group, and they're running around and playing, but also their mom and their aunties and the males in the group and everyone else. And they learn what to do and what not to do. There are social rules to being a monkey, right? And when you break those rules, you get cuffed in the head or you know, get bitten or something like that. And so they see the adults respond to snakes. What's really amazing is that many monkey species have calls for snakes and calls for eagles or different kinds of alarm calls. But you have to learn how to do them. So they're wired, in a sense, to respond to danger. But the way in which you respond is shaped by your social learning, which is really funny because you can see some of these teenage monkeys every now and then will see an eagle or a snake and they'll give the wrong call and all the adults will sort of look up and down and look around and trying to figure it out. But again, it just goes to show how social collaboration, it's central. I mean, it's so important for humans, but I think we undervalue how important it is for so many other species too.
Would a monkey born in captivity in a zoo that's never seen a snake be scared of snakes?
So most mammals freak out when they see a snake. And one of the arguments is that we have, as mammals, there's certain visual processes that we key into. And everyone will notice this. When you're walking along, if the light is a little low and things are happening on your peripheral vision, you're cued into that. You notice. You turn around. It can freak you out. It can actually stimulate the flight or fight response. Snakes do that as well. Things that are unknown and slithering tend to, for a pretty good reason, freak out most mammals.
And probably the thicker and longer the snake is. Is that true?
I think it's more about the movement, the pattern of movement. So, for example, I would have thought, based on danger, that poisonous snakes like vipers would be really avoided by monkeys. So imagine my surprise about 20 years ago when I'm hanging out with this group of monkeys to see six little young monkeys approach a pit viper, a dangerous genus Trimacerus. This thing would have killed me or killed one of them easily if it bit them. They're standing around the viper and they'd whack it on the head and it would turn and strike at them. They'd hop back and the other one would come up behind it and whack it on the tail and it'd turn around. And they were harassing an incredibly poisonous animal. So I would think that's a pretty stupid approach. But you know what? They probably knew better than I did.
We're talking to anthropologist Agustin Fuentes. We were talking a moment ago, before we got sidetracked on the snake conversation, about how we evolved as primates to be scared of things with claws, you know, big animals with claws and fangs and so on, but not to be scared of viruses. Right. And so here we are in this world where, despite the many horrifying wars and acts of terrorism and aggression and all kinds of things going on around us, we are still fundamentally a cooperative species, right, with language where we can learn from one another. And we do a pretty good job of that. And yet we still seem to not be dealing with the actual threats to our future.
So, I mean, that's a really good example. And part of that is the last 10,000 years, we've increased something that's made it more complicated to get along really well and to make stuff work. And that's called inequality. Really, with sedentism, agriculture, accumulation of surplus, and more complex social and political realities, we have more and more inequality. And that inequality drives differential access to goods. And that can create a problem. It's not an insurmountable problem. So let's go back to viruses or bacteria, things that we know now are very damaging. So given all the wars and everything on the planet, it's not warfare that's killing more people. It's actually diarrhea that is one of the biggest risks on the planet. And that's because of dehydration or different kinds of bacterial or viral infections. We know this. We know how to treat them. And yet, because of the different political and social contexts, that's not our main priority. So we've worked ourselves into a bit of a conundrum here.
And is there a way, using our evolutionary tools, to get ourselves out of that conundrum?
I think so. So one of the things that becomes really apparent when we look to the last 2 million years of human evolution, the really critical part that differentiates us from other things on the planet, that what makes us distinctive, it's a particular kind of cooperation and collaboration, a particular building of community. And we've moved away recently, politically and actively and economically, from the notion that community and the health of the community should actually be one of the most important things that we do. We know, evolutionarily speaking, that's really a central feature of humanity. And so when we reshift our focus a little bit more to the health of communities, not, and I'm not arguing for egalitarianism, not that everyone's going to be the same or have the same access, but to have some pattern or process where communities can benefit more than just individuals. That actually is really important, and that has a long history in our evolution.
My understanding is that egalitarianism has a long history in our evolution.
That's actually a misrepresentation. Humans are almost never egalitarian. Almost nothing is. Now, people mistake egalitarianism for small-scale societies. So true egalitarianism is that there's no one in command, right? There's no hierarchy. All primates have hierarchies, so all humans have hierarchies. But we've had egalitarian political organization, right? That is where there's no fixed hierarchy where one type of person is always going to have more than others. That is new, right? In the past, that wasn't the case as much. But of course, there's hierarchies. Some people do better at running stuff than others. And some people allow that. Some people don't allow that. I think what we have to be aware of is how the hierarchies are constructed, how they're maintained, and what their purpose is. I mean, hierarchy is not a bad thing. But severe inequality is. And we've got really good evidence for that.
The reason I said that is because we had the anthropologist Christopher Bohm on the air a while back, who'd written a book called Moral Origins. And we talked about his research, in which he said that hunter-gatherers hunt, chimpanzees hunt, and they distribute food in a really different way. So that hunter-gatherers, the guy who does the hunting and get, you know, makes the kill, will be a different person than the person who distributes the meat, because they want it to be fair and they want everybody to get meat. And that's a kind of egalitarianism, isn't it?
Yes. No, Dr. Bohm's work is fantastic, and he's exactly right. So let's shift, put chimpanzee hunting to the side, because that's a really different thing. What we see in most small-scale societies is a kind of distribution of goods so that inequality is minimized. Not that it disappears, so that it's minimized. So the big, really good hunter in many societies, when he or she is very successful, they then distribute that food to everyone so that that one individual's status is not too high And so that individual doesn't think too much of him or herself. We have these leveling mechanisms in small societies because in a small society, it's back to this idea of community. We all actually have to work together to make this work, especially in a foraging society. So if you got one person who's not sort of really participating equally with everyone else, that's a problem. And what Dr. Boehm's work shows is that in small-scale societies and foraging groups, there is a push towards what they call egalitarian, which just means reduced inequality.
And so those leveling mechanisms serve to do exactly what we've been talking about all along, which is to make for a more cooperative society in which
Absolutely.
Everybody participates.
Absolutely. And so participation and community contribution. Not everyone is going to do exactly the same thing. We don't want that. We want a little bit of diversity. But you don't want massive inequality. Let's look at modern societies around the planet today. One of our biggest problems is inequality in access, and that leads to violence, and it leads to all types of cruelty. And we know how those patterns emerge. Not that we're going to get rid of inequality. Inequality is here to stay. For the last 10,000 years, we've been building more and more unequal systems. However, we do know that our bodies and minds have evolved over millions of years to be really good at finding cooperative solutions that reduce inequality.
Your lecture is titled Human Evolution, A Cocktail of Creativity. When I think about evolution from, and I'm a total layman. I mean, I don't know how you guys do what you do. I mean, it's stunning that you can make so many conclusions from the fossil record and about rainforests and so on. But when I look at this huge process that goes from these little single-celled organisms that somehow came together to the huge diversity of species that we have on the planet, all of that seems like a set of ongoing creativity.
Yeah.
And that nature itself is fundamentally creative.
Life is creative.
Yeah.
That's one of the most amazing things. Life is cooperative and creative. If we could end right there, that's actually one of the things. And if people just recognize that, I think people's lives would be a little bit better. Because we have this notion that things are all competitive and it's all about sort of losing or winning. It's actually much more open than that and a lot more messy. So life is creative. If we look at just walk out your door and look at everything around you, you'll see an enormous array of creative solutions to the complex challenges organisms face. They're not always successful, but the ones that are work really, really well.
Life can I think of one of the things that always blows my mind is ice worms.
Right.
Like somebody can live inside of ice.
Yeah.
But I mean, as you say, in the yard, there's all kinds of life growing on my fence.
Right.
What is special about human creativity?
So human creativity mixes together a range of things that many other organisms have, but not all in one package. So part of that is our incredible cognitive complexity. Many other organisms are quite cognitively complex, very smart, very intelligent, but humans mix this particular kind of intelligence with another capacity, a kind of imagination, a capacity to move beyond the material of the here and now to imagine a future that is totally different. Humans have a kind of hope and imagination that has opened the world up for us, sometimes leading to horrible outcomes, other times leading to really incredible outcomes. That's the distinction in humans, this imaginative creativity.
It's such a mixed thing because, I mean, in the blurb for your lecture, it says, we are neither the nastiest nor the nicest species. I've always thought that we were exactly that. We are the nastiest in the sense
right.
that we come up with ways to imprison and hurt and torture each other that probably goes beyond the worst thing that a cat does to a mouse when it's playing with
right.
it and things like that. And in our incredible love and accommodation for one another and for our handicapped and for our elderly and so on, we're awfully nice.
Right, right. Yeah, so maybe I should have said we are the nastiest and nicest. The thing is, we have the broadest range of potential. And we're showing that right now. Look at the Anthropocene. Look at the climate. Look at the world right now. We are showing that we have probably, as a species, the most impact since, let's say, blue-green algae, which, you know, sort of pushed a bunch of oxygen into our atmosphere. of anything in the history of the planet. So we have all of these capacities to do this. The reason I say we're not the nicest or the nastiest is there are too many people that are trying to make that distinction. We're either all good or we're either all bad, right? Deep in our hearts lies the, you know, the Mr. Hyde to our Dr. Jekyll, or other people say, no, 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 we're all, you know, happy and would run holding hands with the flowers. It's neither of those things.
Or both.
Or it's all of the things, but we can't use these as counterpoints. It's not nasty or nice. It's the underlying capacity that allows us to do all of these kinds of things. And creativity, a kind of cooperative, collaborative creativity, is what underlies us. So that should be inspiring and hopeful, even at the same time that it's very worrying. Because this same thing that allows us to create amazing solutions to the challenges of the world also allows us to really mess things up.
In one of your books, you devote yourself to a kind of myth-busting. Mm. Busting of myths about aggression, and I guess we've talked about that a little bit in the sense that you've been talking about how much more of a cooperative species than an aggressive or competitive species we are. You also bust myths about race and gender and things like that. Right. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, let me be clear. There's lots of aggression and lots of violence in humans. It's our capacity, not our destiny. And I think that's a really important difference. So why bust myths? Well, one of the biggest problems with scientific research is that it remains in the academy. And popularizing of science is done fairly poorly for the most part. So the reason I like to bust myths is I like to take the information that we have from deep decades, millennia even, of investigation, and make that accessible to a broader public to show that many of the things we assume are truisms about being human are in fact not supported by the data. So things like biological race, you know, the way we think of black, white, Asian, other, these are not biological entities. These are socially constructed entities. They're very real. They're very important. But there are not different kinds of human, biologically speaking. Gender, right? The idea of sex and gender. People have so many assumptions about what males and females are and what they do. It's just not supported by the data. Now, there are big differences between the sexes. But gender is a whole range of ways of being human in the world, and not correlated to whether or not you have two X's or an X and a Y as your chromosomes.
Would you say the same thing about primates?
So, to a lesser extent, humans have gender because gender is the cultural, historical, social interpretation of the roles of the sexes. Primates just have male and female. Now, they have a range of ways to be male and female, but we humans take that to the nth degree. We expand it even more. So, most primates, most social mammals have very complex roles for males and females, but they don't have gender the way humans do.
They have complex roles for males and females. Does those shift culturally between, say, one group of monkeys and another?
That's a very good question. So you'll see some shifting, right? But nothing like you see with humans. Nothing like you see with humans. And the problem is, we think humans are fixed like many other organisms. There are clear biological differences and patterns between males and females, but there are way more similarities than we think so. We're the same species, right? We come from the same stuff. And sometimes we let gender differences, which can be enormous, cloud our understanding of sex differences.
What would you say the actual sex differences are in human beings?
Well, I mean, there are critical sex differences, right? Females gestate and lactate.
Right.
But that's actually a very, very important one. But these things like aggression, well, we've got to step back. If we actually look at the data, males and females are pretty much the same in aggression, except for particular kinds of aggression in particular societies, right? In some cases, we see more violent physical aggression from males, but more violent social aggression from females. But that varies by age and it varies by society. Other things like capacity to do different kinds of work, right? The reason that most politicians in the United States are male is not because males are better at being politicians, right? There's a historical and social pattern there. The gender pay gap, it's not because females are less capable of doing jobs. It's because we have social and gender expectations. So there are biological differences. So, for example, males on average are slightly taller and larger than females. And in fact, males on average have higher muscle density in their upper body, making males slightly stronger than females. But there are many, 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 many females that are stronger than many, many, many males. The overlap is enormous.
Yeah, the two bell-shaped curves where there's way more overlap than you would have thought. when you talk about more politicians being, you know, vastly more politicians being male and the gender pay gap and things like that, those go back to the kind of inequality and essentially failure of the leveling structures in our society.
Right. As we get more unequal, the problem is it's very recent, and this is what people don't understand. When we look back 20,000 years, 40,000 years, 100,000 years in the material, archaeological, and fossil record, there has to be gender there, but we don't see it. We don't see it the way we see it now. In fact, it isn't until about 14 or 15,000 years ago that we can find in the body, let's say in teeth, slight different chemical makeup showing that males and females might be eating slightly differently. Before that, we don't find those differences. Now, there's a few interesting things. We find a couple differences in tooth wear in some Neanderthal fossils showing that males and females might have been working leather slightly differently with their teeth. But if that's the extent of gender differences, let me give you an even better one. This is one of my favorite ones. Everyone knows about the handprints, early cave art. Our ancestors for the last 40,000 years have been chewing berries and pigments and spitting them out over their hands to leave the silhouette, right, the outline of the hand. So whenever you see a reconstruction of people doing cave art, it's always males painting in the caves. We don't know that, right? We have no idea. So someone went back, a researcher and archaeologist named Snow, went back and looked at all of the examples of these handprints that we have. You can measure male and female hands, so you can tell difference because there's some nice biological differences in the way males and female hands are shaped. Turns out, more than 60% of all of those handprints that we know of for the last 40,000 years were done by women.
That's so cool. So you measure the handprints, and then you have the fossil record of the size of male and female hands in that region.
And what's even more amazing is that many of these handprints are done of children. And my favorite one is they just did analysis of a 12,000-year-old series of handprints where they thought there were adult hands with little child's hands inside them, which was really amazing. But the hands inside them, they're not even human. They're lizards. For some reason, these people were taking their hands, making the outline, and then taking lizard hands and doing the hands inside of their hands. Who knows what that means? But this is back to this amazing human creativity.
Yeah.
This ability to imbue the world with meaning, which is really what makes us human.
What do you think is the evolutionary advantage of that kind of artistic creativity?
So I don't know if there's an advantage to artistic creativity. There is sometimes, but there's also a great detriment. We humans can think ourselves into inactivity all the time because of this very creativity. I think it's not so much the end point of our evolution. It's the opening up of the possibilities of our evolution. So I think that's the real power that we have, is that we have many, many options. Some of these options lead us down the wrong path, others don't. But this artistic creativity is a gift, an opportunity that emerged during human evolution to let us really, really make a difference in the world.
And so, like, what difference did the handprints on the cave wall make for us?
Who knows? What's amazing is they meant something to the people who made them. We don't know what it meant, but that meaning, a world, a landscape filled with meaning and the possibility of imagination and hope, that's what makes humans human.
Agustin Fuentes is a professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame. He will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the New Mexico History Museum. His lecture is titled Human Evolution, A Cocktail of Creativity, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research, which is on the web at sarweb.org. Agustin, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.